Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And I'm looking at the aftermath of Mao's death today. There's a huge amount to be said about this, and there is a kind of an intense debate at the moment, as there has been for the last kind of 20 years at least, about the direction China is taking since the self-appointment of Xi Jinping as China's president for life. China watchers, as kind of academics in that field go, seeming increasingly like the kind of those Kremlinologists of the Cold War, who were interested in the kind of the goings on inside the Kremlin and who's got the upper hand and this, that, and the other, and you know what power transitions are taking place and who calls the shots. For my interest is more in the kind of the social history of China. I'm generally more interested in people than in what leader has decided to make what normally fairly despotic decision. And a great book to look at in order to consider that, and also to consider the ideas that have shaped China and the rest of the world, is Julie Lovell's Maoism, A Global History. And towards the end of the book, she writes a chapter called Mao-ish China, which is an amusing play on words, but belies a key point that after Mao's death, aspects of Maoism were retained and others were junked. And currently, the version of Mao is kind of seen something kind of like a resurgence in under Xi's watch, particularly in the creation of a surveillance state. The bits that are kind of being discarded are the relentless war on institutions that Mao brought about in the last 10 years of his life, the Cultural Revolution. China is kind of less, the Chinese Communist Party is obviously for very good reasons, less drawn to that. But let's begin by looking at the kind of Mao's immediate, the immediate aftermath of Mao's death. Julia Lovell writes, "In the late 1950s, Mao occupied the northern half of Tiananmen Square. His 6-meter-long portrait, suspended from the viewing platform on which he surveyed admiring crowds, gazed down at his words, inscribed in his own calligraphy, on the monument to the heroes of the revolution. After his death, Mao annexed the rest, the south of the square, when, in 1977, his orange embalmed body was set inside a large mausoleum in order, party plans explained, to underline further the political meaning of Tiananmen Square." The idea of implanting a meaning on a political or on a geographical space is kind of a hugely important thing to consider when we're looking at mausoleums and public memory and monuments. If you go back a few episodes, probably quite a few now, I did a thing on the statue, the great Stalinist statue, the Motherland Calls, that was established after the Second World War at the site of the Battle of Stalingrad. But in other respects, writes Julia Lovell, things were not going Mao's way. Less than a month after his demise in September 1976, the executors of the Cultural Revolution, the so-called Gang of Four, his wife Jiang Qing and her three collaborators Yao Wen Yuan, Zhang Chung Chao, and Wang Hong Wen were arrested. Although one of Mao's proteges, the faithful Hunanese Party Secretary Hua Guofeng, directly succeeded Mao, he reigned on borrowed time. For Deng Xiaoping, arguably the toughest of Mao's surviving first-generation revolutionary peers, was busy manoeuvring himself into the paramount leadership. By 1980, Deng had mobilised enough support among the party elite to push Hua out of any meaningful position of power. In culture, economics and foreign policy, the headline story of the 1980s was de-Maoification. The first sign of unravelling came in The Economy. Already by the early 1970s, some rural communist cadres, perhaps exhausted by the caprices of central party directives, had allowed local farmers to escape some of the tyrannies of central socialist planning. Here we must pause for a moment because this is hugely important. There was a thesis put forward, and to be honest, initially I looked at it and I wasn't sure, by Frank Dakota, who wrote Mao's Great Famine, and he also wrote The Cultural Revolution of People's History. This idea that the Cultural Revolution came to an end because of a kind of people's revolution against Maoism. Again, I wasn't sure. I looked at it, I thought, okay, it's a thesis, I'm not wholly convinced, but Julie Lovell is making a similar point here, that by the early 1970s, Maoism had kind of exhausted China. It had, since 1949, over the course of about 25 years, it had caused unimaginable economic hardship. It caused a huge famine. It had been enforced with immense violence. And more than anything else, on a day-to-day basis, which is how people experience things, it had created huge obstacles that the peasants had never previously really encountered between themselves, the local markets, and how they sustained themselves and how they managed their time, their energies, and their work. Collectivisation and communalisation saw peasants during the Great Leap Forward and the subsequent famine dragged from the land and forced to build dams and things like that, you know, worked to death. But more significantly, famines broke out for a variety of reasons. One, because there was nobody doing the traditional work of farming. So party cadres, the kind of the local bigwigs and enforcers, and often enormously corrupt characters in their own right, the party cadres began to look on Maoism and the edicts of Maoism as a kind of a busted flush, something that could be dispensed with or ignored. Mao had created this culture during the Cultural Revolution by saying, challenge authority, challenge bureaucracy. The party itself has become corrupted. This was sort of Mao's kind of epic temper tantrum after having been removed from power following the Great Leap Forward and the subsequent disaster. So that here we have two very well respected historians saying roughly the same thing. So no doubt there is something in it, but it's interesting to see that entrepreneurialism in China never went away. It was there. It was heavily suppressed during the high years of Maoism. But also, entrepreneurialism wasn't the product of Deng Xiaoping. It's kind of there in peasant societies across the world. Peasants are, out of necessity, enormously enterprising people. She writes, "Freewheelers carved up individual plots from communes, sowed non-staple crops that were extremely profitable in a growing black market, and returned to sideline occupations such as animal rearing and handicrafts that had been condemned as capitalists since the mid-1950s. There was a probably apocryphal tale, but it's worth telling anyway, of Mao showing Khrushchev around China, probably in about 1957-58, during the beginnings of the Great Leap Forward and the subsequent disaster. And they were going through somewhere in rural China and driving up a road and seeing a peasant selling the last of his possessions for some rice to eat. And Mao said, "You see, that's how it all starts up again. That is capitalism. There's somebody trying to sell things," which is a kind of a very perverse understanding of what capitalism is. And Mao's answer was, "That's why we must continue to ruthlessly enforce our kind of state-led, Marxist-Leninist, Maoist suppression of the capitalist class." And of course, this is just an individual trying not to starve to death. But that was the extent to which all enterprise, all commerce, all exchange was stamped out. In South China, goods supposedly controlled by government monopoly were openly sold privately. Gangs of entrepreneurs roamed the coastline trading in contraband. Deng Xiaoping and his lieutenants, such as Zhao Jiang, formalised and accelerated this process. By 1982, the communes, the foundation of Mao's economic and political strategy, had been dissolved. There's a debate about Deng Xiaoping, whether he simply looked at the prospects for the future for Maoism and thought, well, the game is up, really. There's no way that we can stop people buying and selling things. There's no way that we can try to, without such a degree of anarchy as will lead to either civil war or a collapse of the country, there's no way we can do any of those things. And perhaps more seriously, as far as the people like Deng were concerned, there's no way we can continue with the Maoism without destroying the party. And once again, leading to some kind of violent civil war in China. The problem, of course, was what you do about demaoification. How and what steps and at what speed do you move away from Maoism? Because the idea that China would embrace free market capitalism in simply one go, well, that wasn't anything that Deng was thinking. Deng Xiaoping had, it would appear, an open mind. He famously said, "It doesn't matter what colour the cat is, as long as it catches mice." And also famously said that socialism, poverty is not socialism, and socialism is not poverty. The point is not to impoverish people. Though Deng was pretty comfortable with the idea that some degree of inequality would return to China. The equality that China had achieved during Mao's years was generally a levelling downwards, unless you're a kind of party member, then you live quite a nice life. It was about making everybody equally as poor as one another. Deng said that not that some people would get wealthier quicker than others, and that there would be divisions within China. The next point to talk about is the Cultural Revolution.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
During the Cultural Revolution, books by, this is Julia Lovell writing, books by and pictures of Mao have been the safest choice of ceremonial gift. In one, perhaps apocryphal story, a couple received 102 copies of Mao's works as wedding presents. Enough portraits of Mao had been manufactured for each Chinese person to own three. More than a billion Little Red Books had been printed. Now billions of volumes of Mao's works were mouldering in warehouses. I think there was a point that Frank Dakota made in his book on the Cultural Revolution that China essentially ran out of the raw materials for making red books, the little plastic red covers, the paper and the ink, so many were produced. Not only were they taking up space needed for post-Cultural Revolution manuals on modernization, Deng Xiaoping was agitated about how far behind China had fallen in the science and technology during the late Mao era. They were also responsible for 85 million yuan in bad loans and required the round-the-clock guarding by a specialist army division. Despite the best efforts, about 20% of Mao's books succumbed to cracking and mildew thanks to unsteady temperatures. The CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, resorted to radical solutions. On the 12th of February 1979, the propaganda department banned the sale of the Little Red Book and, barring a few copies to be held in reserve, ordered all extant volumes to be pulped within 7 months. Up to 90% of the remaining Mao-era political books were turned into mulch, including the entire run of the fifth volume of Mao's selected works. These kinds of things couldn't be done without a broad popular consensus. There was, of course, a significant body of people in China who mourned Mao, who mourned his passing and grieved for him. There was public protestations of grief in Tiananmen Square long after he passed away. But demaoification wouldn't have been possible without a broad agreement that the Mao years, for the most part, had been a terrible disaster. Often for many years, the party line was that Maoism had been two-thirds bad and one-third good. and a number of other kind of quite opaque answers to a difficult question. The former propagandists of global Maoism no longer believed in the message they had been trained to communicate by student level. In 1978, some of the writers and editors of the Foreign Languages Press, which had churned out Peking Review and other works of external propaganda, were sent to study abroad and finally had an opportunity to view for themselves the Western world, which for decades they had been so certain that China was about to liberate. One foreign language press editor and veteran of the Cultural Revolution's exhausting political and social upheavals was shocked by everyday life in small-town Australia. Before I left China, all the propaganda was about how people in capitalist countries were suffering, oppressed, that anything to do with capitalism was bad, and anything to do with socialism was good. But when we actually went abroad, we found it was nothing like that. The culture shock was very strong. Everything was so different from China, including at the everyday levels of civilization, of civility. Every morning the parents took the children to school and picked them up at the end of the day. I thought, how lucky these children are. I wept to see it. I'd spent all these years doing external propaganda in China, but I had no idea how people were living abroad. There's a famous story of Deng Xiaoping's visit to America. I believe it was in 1979, where he was feted by Jimmy Carter. He'd previously been invited by Gerry Ford, and this was about his second visit to America. And he was at a White House banquet, and Carter, as a Democrat, attracted various Hollywood liberal types. The chief one at the time being Shirley MacLaine. Shirley MacLaine is mentioned in a number of books about Western views on China. Anyway, Shirley MacLaine made during the Cultural Revolution a famously naive film, which is kind of up there with the writings of Sidney and Beatrice Webb on Stalinism for its sort of lack of ability to see the realities of Maoist life. And she said to Deng Xiaoping, "Well, I made this film and I met this marvellous guy who was a physics professor in rural China, and he was working in the fields, and he was so happy. He'd been sent to the countryside to really learn about how the peasants lived and to really change his decadent bourgeois ways, and it had really done him a world of good." To which Deng Xiaoping said to Shirley MacLaine through a translator, "He was lying to you." And of course he was. The man would have been terrified to say anything else. And then he finished off by saying, "Professors should be in universities teaching students," and ended the conversation. And just as there were Chinese propagandists and journalists during the Mao era who had a skewed version in their heads of what the West looked like, there were also Western intellectuals and liberals who had a kind of a wildly misleading idea of what Maoist China was like. The great British socialist politician Tony Benn, during a cabinet meeting in September 1976, when Britain is contemplating its bleak economic future, stood up and said, you know, that the cabinet should have a moment's silence for Mao Zedong, the greatest man in world history. So you have to really ignore the famine that killed potentially 70 million people, 40 to 70 million people, in order to make those sorts of pronouncements. And by the way, for, you know, you're talking to somebody who's read and admired Tony Benn for many, many years. But that aside, the ability of Western liberals and sort of centre-left and socialist politicians to draw kind of misleading or skewed interpretations of revolutionary socialist countries is quite a fascinating aspect of 20th century thought. The distribution warehouses and bookshelves, freshly emptied of musty Maoist volumes, were now refilled with texts that depicted the Mao era with horror, despair and contempt. Now this is the bit that I find really fascinating, that there was such a rapid turnaround in public pronouncements about Maoism. There was a period in the early to mid-1980s when if you were, had suffered under the Cultural Revolution, you could really be outspoken, you could really say it and you could really denounce. The cultural thaw produced a smorgasbord of styles and genres, from semi-abstract poetry to magical realist fiction and absurdist drama, but most converged on their opposition to life under Mao. They depicted the crushing of the individual, the inhumanities of the Mao cult, the corruption and life-wasting absurdities of socialism, the excesses of the Cultural Revolution, and the horrors of the Laogai prison camps. By the late 1980s, demaoification had entered the fine arts too. Zhang Hongtu, in his Material Mao series, featured the helmsman in a series of undignified postures, disguises and colorations. Mao with the tiger stripes, Mao with the false Stalinist moustache, Mao with pigtails, Mao the lecher ogling the statue representing the goddess of democracy. Irreverence hit the big screen, with the so-called fifth generation of filmmakers demolishing stereotypes about CCP heroes. In 1988, the message reached the small screen also, when the documentary He Shang, Death of the Yellow River, was a wildly popular polemical series attacking the People's Republic of China's backwardness and lack of openness to Western democratic culture. It lampooned Mao worship as the epitome of backward cultishness. So it's hardly a surprise that there is a student uprising the following year. It's hardly a surprise that in 1989 there are pro-democracy protests. In the very year that Soviet communism finally begins to crumble, or finally crumbles, you get the protests in Tiananmen Square, which are bloodily suppressed. The general view amongst reactionaries and conservatives in the Chinese Communist Party was, that's what you get when you allow freedom. That's what you get when you let these things get too far. And Deng Xiaoping's position was quite imperiled and threatened as a result of this thaw and the backlash from within the party. Anyway, I'm going to finish there. I hope you find that useful. And I do want to talk more about Deng Xiaoping, because I think on the podcast, generally, he's slightly overlooked. And his significance as a 20th century figure and the importance of his reforms, if you will, to China are one of the key aspects shaping the current reality that we live under. Anyway, thanks very much for listening. Do check us out at www.explaininghistory.org, and also if you can back our Patreon, which raises a little trickle of money for the podcast, that'd be awesome too. Thanks so much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.